It is 23 minutes past the hour now, and it being Wednesday, it being Doug Greenwald. He joins us now from Columbia, Maryland. Doug, the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. And, Doug, I know Columbia is just on the edge of Washington, D.C. We're talking to Doug just off the air a minute ago. You visited the Museum of the Bible. Did you like it? I mean, that takes multiple days. That's a huge place, isn't it?
I did not cover it all. Yeah. It does take multiple days. As a museum, it is absolutely spectacular. Mm-hmm. And its content surprised me in positive ways. Now, there's a 20 to 30 minute discussion that goes with those summary comments, but maybe we can pick some of that up in the new year.
Yeah, we will.
But I did go through the Nazareth exhibit, which I think for many people would be the highlight of the museum, and that may give us a launching pad for some reflections on the birth of Jesus.
I imagine the curator there, knowing that Doug Greenwald was looking through the Nazareth section, was quaking in his boots.
Well, what was funny is I'm standing in line for lunch, and somebody, all of a sudden I hear, "Rabbi Greenwald, Rabbi Greenwald." And somebody runs up to me and shakes my hand, and it's one of the docents in the Nazareth Village exhibit at the museum. Name is Robbie Pruitt, by the way. Mm-hmm. And he said, "I have read all your stuff. I have watched all your DVDs. I have listened to all your CDs. And I was one of three people who wrote the script for the docents here in the Nazareth exhibit. And I want to let you know, thank you, thank you, thank you. Doug Greenwald is in a lot of our copy."
So, really?
Yeah. Well, that's a feather in your cap. So the truth will out.
Remember Clint Eastwood in some of those Dirty Harry movies say, "Make my day"?
Yeah.
That made my day. Thank you, Jesus.
Well, good. Bet it did.
Well, the Advent season is a topic that, you know, you've been on the air with us now for 6 years. This is the seventh year. And each time we learn new things about the Advent that we didn't know before. And I'll tease you sometimes. I'll talk about how Mary arrived on that donkey and it was 10 o'clock at night and all the motels were closed. And that leads you into the whole truth. You started us off, though, 3 weeks ago, talking about Zechariah and Elizabeth, that is the beginning of the Advent season. That's Luke 1. And you made the excellent point that the birth narrative is in Luke 2. Luke 1 is there for a reason. Read it. And can we sum up kind of Zechariah and Elizabeth? Because I'm anxious to get on to the birth story itself. But
well, it's a story of a righteous couple whom the culture turned on him because she was barren. Mm-hmm. Here's a couple dead center in God's will, okay, for 30, 35 years, and she remains barren. The rabbis have said, if you're barren, we know God doesn't like you. So there's a whole bunch of shame that came their way, dead center in God's will by the religious culture. And we talked about some of the dynamics of that. And the piece that we've left here is that in Luke, first chapter 39, at the time, Mary got ready and hurried to a town in the hill country of Judea where she entered Zechariah's home and greeted Elizabeth. When Elizabeth heard Mary's greeting, the baby leapt in her womb. And what I love about that passage is that finally answered the why question in Elizabeth's life. Why was I barren so long? And the answer is because Mary hadn't even been born for most of those 30 or 35 years that she was barren. And rarely in life do we get answers to the why questions that each of us have in our own life. And here in God's grace, he gives Elizabeth the answer to her why question. Now she understands. Now she gets it. Now she realizes that God was at work. And the dots all get connected and everything comes together, even though it was a great mystery for at least three decades. Well, see, I love that part.
That's
of the
an
story.
Awesome thought, because we started out talking about God's time, the perfect point in history for this to happen. And that was one of the elements. And that's something that most of us don't figure. Figure coincidence. Well, nah. It wasn't.
Yeah, you've heard the definition of coincidence, right? Mm-hmm. God's providence done anonymously.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. Well, then, so Joseph and Mary walked up from Nazareth to Bethlehem, and of course, she was riding that donkey, and all the motels were closed, and it was a starry, starry night. Now, I don't know how we know that.
Well, you know, How would you like to be the person that obsoleted 13 million creches?
That's you, Doug. Yeah.
Yeah, and so far nobody's picketing the building here, you know.
Well, just we should issue this warning right now. If anybody out there has a nativity scene and the three wise men are there, pack them up and put them away. They don't belong there.
But in Luke 2, the very first verse, in those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. Two observations. We're talking about history here. Mm-hmm. This is real stuff. Mm-hmm. This Christmas story is not a nice mythological narrative. And secondly, we learned this when we started doing our Paul's Roman world trips to Italy, that when Rome declared a census, they allowed an 18 to 24 month window of time for it to be completed. See, we immediately come to this notion of a census and think our election day, you know, the first Tuesday in November, where everybody shows up at the same time. Not so. Rome wanted to maximize the participation in their census, and so they had these large window of times because of weather differences, agricultural reasons, you know, sowing and reaping. They didn't want to rip people away from maximizing the taxable revenues that would be generated by their crops. And so the whole notion that a whole bunch of people filed into Bethlehem on one night and therefore there were no vacancy signs just doesn't hold water.
And there were other reasons that Joseph could have been headed for Bethlehem, isn't there?
Well, he's part of the Davidic clan. Mm-hmm. And in the Mishnah, which is the codification of the oral law, which was written in about 200 AD, we learn that the Davidic clan was mandated to be it, provide the infrastructure for the wood offerings in the temple in the month of July. So it's reasonable to assume that every July, Joseph has been migrating 90 miles south to Bethlehem so that he could be part of his Davidic clan's participation in a wood offering in the temple. And one of those Julys, he shows up and he says, "Wow, do I have good news? I am betrothed to a wonderful young lady named Miriam, or Mary," and receives all sorts of congratulations from the clan.
Well, he would have stayed with his family in Bethlehem anytime he was in for the temple work, wouldn't he?
Well, it's mandatory hospitality, so mm-hmm. they have to put him up. I mean, factor that thought in mind. When he shows up again with mm-hmm. a very pregnant Mary, mandatory hospitality has not gone away. It's mandatory in this culture. And the notion that everyone was there at the same time doesn't hold water, so the whole Tom Burdette didn't leave the light on at Motel 6, you know, thing mm-hmm. sort of goes out the window. We think there were probably about 300 homes in Bethlehem at this moment in time. Most of them were single-room homes with a little side partition. It was separated by a big granary where the wheat and the barley was kept. And on the other side of that big granary, floor-to-ceiling separation in this one-room home is about a three-foot space called the kataluma. It means guest room. And in this culture, which is observant Jewish in nature, the rabbis have said that no Jewish man can sleep in the same room with another man's wife. And so you have to have a guest room, modest though it may be, so that you don't create ritual impurity in your house. Okay? So every one of the 300 homes in Bethlehem had a very small guest room. Hospitality is mandatory, particularly to members of your own clan, and particularly to a woman who's about to give birth. Why is it that we're informed in Luke 2 that there was no room for them in the, I'm going to use the wrong word here, in, but the Greek word that supports that translation is kataluma, which means guest room. As far as we can tell, and it's a bit of a surmission, that around 800 AD, the historic Roman church just sort of said, well, let's call it in, you know, and the guest room phrase went away, but it needs to be resurrected because it's accurate in the translation. Why is it that all 300 rooms are off limits to this couple?
Well, so Joseph was knocking on doors of his own clan members, their homes, expecting to be welcomed in.
He probably went to the home first that he stayed before, you know, when he came for the wood offerings. That's where he would have started, because that's where he would have had the strongest relationship. But yes, the corporate guest rooms of the whole town of Bethlehem are off limits to this couple. Now, why would that be? Well, let me suggest an answer. When Joseph shows up, another, perhaps, July, we know it's not December, he has a very pregnant Mary with him. And his clan says, how come we didn't hear about the wedding feast? You know, they're mandatorily to be invited to these things. And Joseph's only response is, well, let's put it this way. I mean, there wasn't one. What? Shame. Can't let you into our guest rooms or any guest room here in this town. You'll make us ritually unclean. You are impure. Adultery. Shame. And so I think one of the glorious motifs of the birth of Jesus is the motif of shame. You say, wow, what are you talking through your hat here? No. While it truly was shameful from the perspective of the Davidic clan, it was beautiful from heaven's perspective, because this babe was going to grow up and lift people out of shame. A shame that he experienced himself the very first day he was born. And he dies on a shameful Roman cross. And so this motif of shame just not only bookends, but permeates the whole life and ministry of Jesus. And I find that tremendously comforting, tremendously encouraging to look at it that way.
You know, there's always talk of how humble the birth was, but that notion of shame, and we have to remember this was an honor-shame society, a culture that was top of mind all the time in almost every daily activity, honor and shame, honor and shame. The shame and the humility go together, don't they?
They do. And so some person in one of those 300 homes in Bethlehem said, look, I can't let you into my guest room, and you know why. But I tell you what, you can go down into the half basement where the sheep or goats, they wouldn't be both, and the chickens are. And you can have that space. Now, you know, I've seen some homes that are reconstructions from architectural drawings from the mid-1800s done by a German archaeologist as to what these sub-basements were like. They're dark. They're dank. There isn't a window to be seen. They smell. Okay. And there's a manger down there, which is a feeding trough. And since this is the southern part of the country, it may not be a stone manger. In the northern part of the country, they'd all be made from soft limestone. But here, they could easily be made from straw and clay. And one source I read said sometimes, even if clay is hard to come by, they'll use animal dung to fabricate this feeding trough. And it's into that kind of a setting, humble. I don't think it gets any humbler than that, that the King of Glory gets placed. Now, there's another wonderful thing here too.
Yeah.
Because it's a manger, okay? And this manger symbolizes humility. When the angel says to the shepherds, I've got good news. Messiah has come, and you will find him in a manger wrapped in swaddling clothes. Now, let's pause on these shepherds. As romantic as shepherding was in Psalm 23, it's unromantic here in the first century, because in the intervening period of time, we have the rabbis. It's a little bit murky how the rabbis emerged, but we certainly know they exist in the first century. And they have decreed that shepherds are people who are, we know God doesn't like, along with barren people, along with lepers, along with tax collectors, along with tanners. It's a growing list of people that God doesn't like. And part of that reason is because they felt that shepherds took their flocks from one hillside to another, and they ended up eating grass that wasn't under their purview. In other words, they were stealing grass for their sheep, and that's a crime. And in the forgiveness theology of rabbinic Judaism, observant Judaism at this moment in time, you have to do reparations before you can have repentance. And now how in the world is a shepherd ever going to repay whoever the owners were of the hills that their sheep ate sheep on? Well, they can't. They won't. And so by definition, if they can't make reparations, they can't be forgiven. They can't receive repentance. And that's part of the reason why we know God doesn't like them.
And now, they can't go to the temple.
I'd have to track that one down. Yeah, it may well be.
This is hyper-legalism, and it reeks of bureaucracy and policy decisions. And yet Temple Incorporated was dependent upon temple shepherds, weren't they?
That's the irony of a lot of this rabbinic Judaism, is the paradoxes that are contained therein. But yes, these are most likely temple shepherds. These are most likely temple flocks. Their purpose is to give birth to paschal lambs. Josephus tells us that upwards of 200,000 paschal lambs are needed every year for Passover sacrifice at the temple. If you've ever been around Jerusalem, there's not a lot of flat land. And so Josephus tells us that the temple flocks were decentralized and distributed all around Jerusalem, including as far south as Bethlehem, which is a fascinating fact. The reason also, these sheep are in the fields at night. Now, they should never be in the fields at night. They should be in sheep pens for protection. Everybody knows that too. So Luke would expect us to be arrested by that observation. And I think a good answer to that lies, these temple flocks are too large. They will not fit in any sheepfold. So that's part of the reason they're out there. But to finish this whole thought up, when the angel says to these despised, scorned shepherds who cannot testify in a Jewish court of law, you'll find him wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger. It's the word manger that says to these scorned shepherds, these are our kind of people. They will accept us. They won't scorn us. They won't reject us like everybody else in this culture. They're so incredibly poor, they'll probably welcome us. And that gives them the courage to go seek the Christ child out. It's all wrapped up in what this word manger represents.
Now, speaking of wrapping up, because there's another word which represents an exquisite piece of the puzzle here, and you said swaddling clothes. And this goes back to where we started, at God's amazing timing. It's a possibility that Jesus was born at the same time during the same season when paschal lambs were being born, and therefore there may have been ewes delivering lambs on the hillsides at night that would demand the shepherd's attention. And tell us what swaddling clothes are.
Well, swaddling clothes are strips of clothes that
cloths, yeah,
would contain at least two purposes in some people's view. One, it's to help wipe off the newborn paschal lamb.
Mm-hmm. So they're stored around the area where the birthing might be happening.
Yeah. The second is, it's part of the burial preparations once a person dies, to be wrapped. So multiple layers to swaddling clothes.
Mm-hmm.
Just in that little word.
The Advent story is not simple, but it is exquisite. And it all goes back to God's timing and his purpose and his plan, and just the most amazing event in history in such a simple, humble way.
I know, and to wrap this up, if God would have asked Adam, after Adam and Eve were forcibly removed from the garden because of their sin, if he'd have said to Adam, do you have any idea how I'm going to fix this mess that you've just created? He never in 10,000 years would have guessed God's plan that the king of the universe would send his son to be born by very poor people in a very humble setting and would ultimately die on a cross. I call it the Adamic riddle. Adam, how are we going to fix this thing? He never would have envisioned how God's plan was going to do it.
We're talking with Doug Greenwald, Preserving Bible Times. And Doug, again, the Senior Teaching Fellow and the Executive Director thereof. Preserving Bible Times has a great website, preservingbibletimes.org. I suspect you can still go there, click on that link on the Broken Road page, and wind up at preservingbibletimes.org. Sign up for that monthly Reflections newsletter. It will make your day, I guarantee it. Doug, Merry Christmas. We will not be here together next week, but we'll pick up the week afterwards. So I'll see you next year.
Shalom, shalom, and Advent blessings until Christmas Day.
Shalom, Doug. Bye-bye.
Merry Christmas, Doug.
Thanks, guys.